Now, tonight's lecture is by Professor David Wilkinson. People have said, what is the title? Well, here it is, Exoplanets, Aliens and God, Who is Out There and What is the Real Future of Humanity? Now, before David comes up to speak, a few words about him. Many of you, I think, will probably have come across him if you listen for Thought for the Day on Radio 4. You will have heard him a few times. He is president of St. John's College, Durham, and is also a professor in the Department of Theology and Religion at Durham University. Now, he has an unusual background in that he started life as a theoretical astrophysicist, ended up with a PhD in that, and where he studied star formation and the chemical evolution of galaxies and terrestrial mass extinctions, if that means anything to you. His expertise in these fields is recognized by his election as a fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society. But after his astrophysics, he went on to study systemic theology at Cambridge, where he also trained for the Methodist ministry. And he served various appointments in the Methodist Church. His current work at Durham University involves the relationship of the Christian faith to contemporary culture, from science to pop culture. He does have two PhDs, which is quite good. So not only does he have one in astrophysics, he's got one in systemic theology, where he explored the future of the physical universe. And his recent books include Christian Eschatology and the Physical Universe, Science, Religion, and SETI. I think that's The Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And When I Pray, What Does God Do? All good books worth reading. David is, unusually for a Methodist, a canon at St. Albans Cathedral and an ecumenical fellow at Liverpool Cathedral. So his reputation goes before him. As I say, many of you will have already heard him on Thought for the Day. So it's a great privilege for us to have David, and we welcome him to speak on this interesting topic, exoplanets, aliens, and God, who is out there, and what is the real future of humanity.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for having me. It's a delight to be here, and thank you for being here this evening. Just as Andrew does this, I have a huge debt of gratitude to Christians in Science. As a young research student, it really helped me think through some of the big issues of science and Christian theology. So I can commend the work of Christians in Science very strongly indeed. Now, I know that you all listen to Radio 4 in the morning. But if occasionally you turn on Good Morning Britain, as I did just a few years ago when Piers Morgan was still on Good Morning Britain, I listened to a very interesting discussion that was going on. The main topic of the morning was a discussion of Love Island. I'm sure you all watched that series intensely. But in the background, Piers was engaged in a Twitter exchange on the topic of, does God exist? So this was going on in the midst of Love Island. And then into the studio came a new news segment, which was, are UFOs real? And the expert who was talking about this was Sean Ryder, the lead singer of the Happy Mondays. And because he'd experienced and talks about having seen a UFO, and there was a young scientist who'd been brought into the studio to try and give a bit of scientific common sense to it, I guess. And I found myself thinking, here in the midst of a discussion about Love Island, does God exist? And do aliens exist? Where is theology in that? Where is Christian faith in the midst of all of that? And as I thought about that, sometimes God has a sense of humor. And so last November, I found myself in that kind of discussion. This time, it wasn't in a television studio. It was in the cathedral in Washington, D.C. Some of you might know the cathedral there. It has this wonderful space window, at which right in the center of it is a piece of moon rock, brought back by the Apollo 11 astronauts and embedded in the stained glass. And I found myself as part of an evening discussion with Bill Anderson at the bottom of the picture, who's the administrator of NASA, and someone called Jeff Bezos. I wonder if you've come across him on any occasion. Avril Haines, who's director of national intelligence in the US. She basically runs the CIA. And Avi Loeb, an old friend of mine, who's a Harvard astrophysicist and believes that certain objects could pass through the solar system coming from alien civilizations. And I found myself there as a theologian, as part of this discussion. Now, what fascinated me, even though it was being held in Washington Cathedral, was that the organizers felt that they needed someone speaking there about Christian faith. And in this area, when we talk about science and space and aliens, and that's what we talked about, our future in space, Jeff Bezos has still not asked me to go up in one of his rockets, by the way. I don't think they've got a rocket big enough for me to do that. But then what we might find as we go out into space, whether there is little green women and little green men elsewhere in the universe, it seemed to me that what does the Christian faith say about such things? Now, I'm a great fan of the Big Bang Theory. I mean, not just the model in physics, but also the TV comedy series about a group of scientific nerds. And if you've watched the series, you'll know that there's a spin-off series called Young Sheldon, which charts the childhood of Sheldon Cooper, this great physicist. And during his childhood in Texas, young Sheldon begins to have a partnering conversation. It's the local pastor, Pastor Jeff. And often these conversations are very helpful indeed. This is one of them, as Pastor Jeff and Sheldon talk about life elsewhere in the universe.
Eternal life in him.
Should I start that again so that we've got the sound? There we go.
That everyone who believes may have eternal life in him. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son.
Here we go.
Yes, Sheldon?
When you said God gave his son to the world, did you mean Earth or the universe?
Earth.
But if God created the universe, wouldn't he want to save all of it?
Yes, he would.
Then why did you say Earth?
Earth is a synonym for the universe.
He's grabbing at straws now.
So if God's plans to save all of the universe, that means a race of octopus aliens light years away could only be saved by Jesus?
Sure.
Even though they never would have heard of him?
Yes.
Even though his appearance might be terrifying to them?
What, why would his appearance be terrifying?
He has four limbs and they have eight.
Okay, that's enough.
No, no. I prayed people would be more interested in my sermons. I suppose I should have been more specific. Sheldon, if these creatures were born without sin, they don't need to be saved by Jesus.
What if an octopus, Adam and Eve, brought sin to their world? Would they be saved by a human Jesus or an octopus Jesus?
So is the Christian response to some of these questions simply, well, we'll come to a time of questions and discussion a little later, and you'll forgive me if at times I'll say I don't know or to it. But I think there are some things that Christians can say about this area, because interesting enough, this area has been discussed for a very long time within Christian theology. And so what I'm going to do this evening, if it's all right with everyone, is first of all, I'm going to talk a little bit about how Christians have thought about many worlds, life beyond the earth. Then we'll do some science together, particularly about one of the key scientific developments of the last couple of decades in this area, which has been the discovery of exoplanets. And then I'll come back to what this might mean for Christian faith. I hope that's all right with everyone. In a sense, that's what I've prepared. So if it's not all right with everyone, then we're in a bit of a fix. But within the question time, you may want to go off into different areas. as we go. Now, I come to this subject with a degree of trepidation. You see there on the screen Giordano Bruno, who was put to the stake and killed in the year 1600. And it's often rehearsed that Bruno was killed because of his speculation about other worlds. That's not quite true. It was largely to do with Giordano Bruno's views on Jesus. Now, I'm not excusing people being put to death on the stake in any way, but Bruno is often provided as a symbol of Christian negativity or fear about other worlds. And then Thomas Paine in The Age of Reason once said, "The person who thinks about both Christianity and life elsewhere knows little of either." So I throw myself onto your mercy this evening in all of that. But what I want to say, contrasting to both of those, is that actually Christian theology has thought about this. It doesn't have all of the answers, but it has a very interesting story to tell. So let's begin with some of the church fathers, those who at the early stage of the church's history did much of the theological heavy lifting with what the Christian faith is all about. And what you find in people like Origen and Ambrose and St. Basil is people exploring questions about other worlds. And the reason that they did that was a very simple theological argument. It was, they said, God is free to create in whatever way God wants to. Who are we to say that we are alone if God can create whatever he wants to do? And within Christian tradition, that's been a very strong argument. We'll come back to that in a little while. But when Thomas Aquinas effectively took the philosophy of Aristotle and baptized it into the Christian faith, rather negative arguments against other worlds began to occur. And that was partly because Aristotle, some of you may remember, had a view of the universe which had the earth at the center. The earth was at the center of everything, and the whole universe was built on crystalline spheres which revolved around the earth. And that move to say that humans at the center of everything quickly became coupled with the only way that we can understand human significance is if we are at the center of everything. We are alone and unique. That's what makes us special as human beings. And that was a rather unhelpful way of taking into the Christian faith certain Greek ideas. Now, Aquinas himself was a complicated theological character. He actually had a great view of God's extravagance. So this wasn't Aquinas himself, but it was those who followed Aquinas' lead in the dominance of Aristotle. Something in another lecture, by the way, led to many of the problems with Galileo or the church's view of Galileo. But there were other voices which kept coming back to the importance of other worlds. This is Etienne Tempier, the Bishop of Paris, who in 1277 provided over 200 problems or condemnations, as they were called then, with Aquinas' use of Aristotle. One of which, Tempier said, was that by putting human beings at the center of everything, you ruled out God's ability to create in lots of different ways and the possibility of other life. And then Nicholas of Cusa, in the 15th century, made a key theological move which encouraged people to believe in other worlds. And Nicholas of Cusa made this theological move. He said, human beings are special not because of our place in the universe. Human beings are special because of relationship. It's the gift of relationship that God gives in creation, which we see in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, that really gives human significance. So when I have dinner with my family at home, I don't need to sit at the head of the table to feel special. I can sit wherever I want around the table because of the relationship of love that gives me that sense of relationship and being special. That was Nicholas of Cusa's move. And you see, therefore, a number of voices here that throughout Christian history are saying, we want to understand that God could be creating other life beyond the earth. And in fact, as some of the early astronomers, people like Christiaan Huygens and Richard Bentley, began to discover something of the scale of the universe with some of the new telescopes. And I've done a bit of a cheat here because they didn't see this picture of the sky. This is a Hubble telescope picture of the sky, the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. But they began to see the vast distances and the vast numbers of stars and galaxies within the universe. Astronomers like Huygens and Bentley began to say, well, Psalm 19 verse 1 says the heavens declare the glory of God, but we now know that the universe is so big that there's going to be parts of the universe that human beings will never see. So they said, how will the glory of God ever be seen? Well, they said the answer is easy. There are other life, other consciousness out there that will see the glory of God. Now, I don't commend that theological argument to you, but it's interesting that those theological arguments were being used. And so what we've got within the history of Christian thought, and I've done a little bit of a cheat here because the background to the slide is just one of my favorite astronomy slides. This is Christiaan Huygens' telescope, which is basically two mirrors held together by a piece of string. Astronomy today is just a slightly different form in the James Webb telescope. But you've got some voices which are negative about other life within the Christian tradition. Some who want to follow that tradition of Aristotle, that we're at the center of everything, worried about human status. And then as we'll come on to a little later this evening, if you're still awake and the oxygen in the room hasn't gone, we'll talk about sin and salvation. How does the Jesus event relate? So those were the voices against. But the overwhelming number of voices were wanting to be open to the possibility of other worlds because God was free to create. And the God of Scripture is a God of extravagance. If you ever read the book of Genesis, particularly the first chapter, you just get a sense of the diversity and extravagance that God gives. I love the understatement of Genesis 1 where the writer writes, he made the greater light and the lesser light, and then the great understatement of the Bible, and he made the stars also. You ever seen that? God is so great that he created 100 billion stars in each of 100 billion galaxies. By the way, he made the stars also. This is a God of extravagant diversity. And because, as Nicholas of Cusa had said, human status was not threatened by us not being at the center of everything. We were special because of relationship. That freed Christians to think this way. And because the laws of physics, the laws of nature, were universal because of a universal creator, the same laws that could have brought about human life on this earth could provide life on other planets. And then particularly, the importance here of observation. You notice the argument that if God is free to create, you can't work God out or the universe out by logic or human understanding. The only way to work out what the universe is about is to look at it. The importance of observation, the importance of empirical science. And that's why I think historians are right to stress the important contribution of the Judeo-Christian tradition to the growth of modern science. As Kepler said, science is thinking God's thoughts after him. You have to look at what God has done in observation in order to understand what the universe is about. Now, that's where we've got theologically. Are you ready for a bit of science? Let's do that. If I was giving this lecture back in the mid-90s, and I know we've postponed this lecture because of the pandemic, but if we'd postponed it back to the mid-90s, I would have said that we are only sure of a certain number of planets in the universe. And those planets are within our own solar system. And in the mid-90s, the planets around our own solar system were the only planets that we knew about. From 1995 onwards, we've begun to see many planets around other stars. Some, for example, around Alpha Centauri, which is our closest star system, about 4 light years away. And day after day, you'll have seen headlines on websites of planets being discovered. And this is a plot. Don't worry, this is the only graph I'm going to show this evening. This is a plot of the number of planets discovered over that period of time, from the mid-90s through to the present day. Now, you notice a couple of things about this plot. The first is that the early planets that were discovered were very large planets. The y-axis here is the mass as a ratio of the mass of Jupiter. So the yellow line shows planets around the size of Jupiter, which is a big gas giant. As time has gone on, and we've begun to see smaller planets due to some of the techniques that I'll show you in a moment, you see just how many planets there are, many of them close to the size of the Earth. Now, this is the position as it was yesterday when I downloaded the graph. It's probably changed since then. But as of yesterday, we have seen or identified 5,014 extrasolar planets elsewhere around different star systems, of which about 180 or so are terrestrial planets, about the size of the Earth. That's an amazing number. And you may say to yourself, well, how do you see a planet? Because if it's a long way away, doesn't the planet just become invisible compared to the glare of a star? And you'd be right. It's like having a small torch right next to a searchlight. It's very difficult to see because the searchlight blots out the small light. And over the last 20 years, 3 methods have been used primarily to discover some of these 5,000 or so exoplanets. I'm going to tell you about them now, because I think they're really cool. Some of you may want to take a break just at this point if the science doesn't excite you as much as me, so forgive me. The first is called the radial velocity method. And as a planet goes round its star, it is in orbit. But actually, the motion of the planet around the star leads to a little wobble in the star due to gravity. So the question was, could you see the little wobble of the star due to the invisible planet that's going round? And we have something in the universe called the Doppler shift, which means that if an object is emitting light and it moves towards you, the light will be slightly bluer than it should be. If it moves away from you, it'll be slightly redder than it should be. And so in this animation, What this represents, you see the planet there going around the star wobbling a little bit, and the colors, the spectral lines, are moving backwards and forwards, depending on the Doppler shift, the star moving towards us and away from us. That is a wonderful method for seeing what the radius of the planet is and its minimum mass. And that was the first method that was used. But there's a second method, and it's much more powerful. And the second method was to say that as a small planet moves in front of a star, if you're looking directly at it and you see the planet move in front of the star, then the amount of light from that star just dips, just a little bit. You see it there as the planet moves across the surface of the star. And that tells you an awful lot about the planet, that little dip of light. Now, of course, you've got to be looking directly at the star. So you've got to have the planet in the plane, right plane, in order for this to happen. This isn't an easy thing to do. So what you have to do is look at lots and lots of stars all at the same time and go back and look at them again. And the Kepler satellite did this, just a little bit of the Milky Way galaxy it looked at, and recorded a number of these. Then it lost its bearings, literally, and it had to be reprogrammed to do a little bit more. Well, this is just an animation of some of the stars and planets that it discovered. Now, lots of different systems, lots of different sizes of stars, lots of different sizes of planets. Sometimes we found planetary systems with two stars. We never expected that, although the writers of Star Wars had created a planet called Tatooine, where actually you have two stars in the sky. They were right. What this is saying, of course, is there's lots of planets out there. But there's a third method, which is even cooler than the first two methods. Can you believe this, that there's a third method? And this is called gravitational lensing. And Albert Einstein said that light can be bent by the presence of massive objects. And so imagine a situation where you have a star a long way away, and another star moves in front of that star. Well, the mass of the star in between, the distant star and you, bends or curves the light. And the light is gravitationally lensed, which means it just gets a bit brighter as this star moves in front. And not only can you see that, you can also see a planet which is going around this star in the form. And that causes gravitational lensing as well. And the fact that we've even seen this means the conclusion that there's a lot of planets out there. So we're slowly coming to the conclusion that probably most stars have their own planetary systems. Perhaps the majority of stars have their own planetary systems. Now, once we've got to that, then, gosh, that's a lot of planets out there. And you might say to yourself, well, there's 100 billion stars in each 100 billion galaxies. That means, well, how many stars are there in the universe? Really easy. I know it's late on a Thursday night, but multiply 100 billion by 100 billion, and the answer is a lot. That's something like the grains of sand on the beaches of the world. Now, if the majority of those star systems have planets, that's an awful lot of planets, and people say, well, there must be another Earth with intelligent life out there. Fair point, but not conclusive. So let's just remind ourselves that one or two things, remembering Goldilocks, have to be just right for a terrestrial planet like the Earth to produce life. And one of the goals of the James Webb Telescope is particularly to look at the atmospheres around some of these planets to see whether they are just right. Because there's a number of things that you have to get just right. First of all, the planet has to be in what's called the habitable zone around a star. That is, it has to be in a place which is not too hot and not too cold as it orbits a star. The Earth is in the habitable zone. Mars and Venus are on the kind of edges, and so they don't quite work. And so you've got to have a planet in the habitable zone. And this is a system from one of the Kepler observers' observations, Kepler 452b, which has a planet within the habitable zone. That's good. But then you've got to have the right kind of star. Because if your star is too big, it rushes through its life cycle and explodes far too early before life has had time to develop. If your star is too small, it doesn't quite have the output in terms of radiation that you need. So we've seen some terrestrial planets around the right kind of stars. So everything's looking good here. Maybe there's another Earth with another person droning on and on about science and theology elsewhere. But just hold on a moment. Because there are certain scientific arguments which are very strong in arguing against intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, even if you have lots and lots of planets. The first is this. And that is, can I put it like this? It's a long way from an amoeba to an accountant. Oh, well, we can talk about that later. Even if you have basic life, primitive life, it is a long journey to get to intelligent life and conscious intelligent life. Now, a number of these steps are well known. Some of them are not well known, particularly what we mean by consciousness. But we do know that this evolutionary process needs very careful types of environment to allow it to progress. So it's a long way from an amoeba to an accountant. That might mean that there's lots of primitive life out there in the universe, but maybe not intelligent life. And the second argument against intelligent life came from Enrico Fermi in the 1950s, outstanding physicist. And Fermi went to lunch with some of his scientific friends. And as they went to lunch, they were having a conversation about a couple of news stories that had been in the newspaper at the time. One was claims about seeing flying saucers. The second was about the disappearance of trash cans in New York City. And in a famous cartoon in The New Yorker, the cartoonist had put the two together. And Fermi and his friends were having some conversation and laughter about this, and talking about whether flying saucers were the best type of objects for interstellar flight. And Fermi went silent. And Fermi occasionally did this. And what he was doing was he was doing a calculation in his head. They sat down, had lunch, and halfway through the lunch, Fermi looked up and said, "Where is everybody?" Now, this became known as the Fermi paradox. If they existed, they would be here, was what Fermi was saying. And what he'd done is he'd done a very, fairly simple calculation, but for the first time. He'd asked himself the question, if you have a galaxy of stars, and from your home star, you send out self-replicating probes. So these are simple robotic probes which go to a new star system, and once they're in a new star system, they find a way of replicating, of building copies of themselves from the raw materials there, and then they send out probes to other star systems. And you build in some redundancy, some crash, some can't reproduce, some go to the same star system, all the rest of it. You have them traveling at not warp factor 10 or anything of that sort in Star Trek terms. You have them using current rocket technology, so fairly low level. And you ask yourself the question, how long would it take a civilization to visit the 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy? And what Fermi came to was a number not too distant from what we believe today, and that is a number of 300 million years to colonize every star in the Milky Way galaxy. And you may say, that's a very long time. It feels worse than this lecture, by the way. But in fact, compared to the age of the galaxy, it's very short. Because the age of the galaxy is something like 10 billion years. So Fermi said, if life is developing in lots of places, if it's easy to develop, if it moves easily to intelligent life, then it should have already visited the Earth. If they existed, they would be here, was the Fermi paradox. Now, of course, you can respond to that. Leo Szilard, a friend of Fermi, a Hungarian physicist, replied to Fermi's, if they existed, they would be here, by saying they are here and they're called Hungarians. That was Szilard's response. And of course, there are many people who believe that we are a visited planet. We can talk a little bit about that in the question time if you want to. I don't want to dismiss this. I want to take this seriously in terms of looking at the evidence. I think a lot of the claims are hoaxes. We've seen that over the years, and people have admitted that they've been hoaxes. I think the whole area of conspiracy theories comes into this with lots of different ways of spinning the lies here, there, and everywhere. I think there may be a case for what some people have called sleep paralysis, where in a kind of halfway wake dream state, you think that you've encountered aliens. There are even those who've talked about electromagnetic pulses. There are some who've talked about angels and demons appearing. But I also think that the question for me is there enough evidence? And I'm not convinced by that, but I'm happy to talk about it. So for what it's worth, my own view, tentatively, is this. And that is that we are probably alone as intelligent life within this galaxy. That's not to say that there may be lots of primitive life out there. If you're a fan of Star Trek, that's not terribly interesting to boldly go to seek out even more amoebas. But I think that may be the case. There may be primitive life, but not intelligent life. But that doesn't, and that's because of the Fermi paradox. I think that's a strong argument. But there may be life in other galaxies, but that has a problem of communication to it. So if an intelligent civilization in the Andromeda galaxy sends a message to us saying, hello, is there anyone there? It will take a few million light years to reach us. If we then receive that message and send a message back saying, well, yes, we're here, who are you? That takes a few million light years to get back. That's not a very interesting conversation, to be honest. But there's a profound point there, and that is that there may be intelligent life, but so far away that we will never see it. Okay? So what I've tried to do so far is say a little bit about the history of Christian theology in this area. I've tried to just sketch out briefly some of the scientific arguments for and against intelligent life. Let me come to the final part of the talk, if I may. And that is to say, what are the theological or religious implications of some of this? And a number of scientists have made different claims about this. Paul Davis, distinguished cosmologist and popularizer of science, actually believes that if we discovered other life, it would be evidence for cosmic design. He says, if life is widespread in the universe, It gives us more, not less, reason to believe in cosmic design. Now, he's not saying that I believe in a cosmic designer. He's saying maybe it poses the question, is there a deeper story to the universe? Not trying to prove God, but is there something which is saying there's more to this universe than meets the eye? If he's positive about the religious implications, there are others who are negative. This is Jill Cornell Tarter, one of the leading figures of SETI research, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. If you've seen the movie Contact, the Jodie Foster character in that movie is based on Jill Tarter. And she says that long-lived extraterrestrials either have had or have outgrown organized religion. Her view is that if extraterrestrials visited us, they would be so advanced, they would have left behind simple religion. I don't agree with that, as you might expect, partly because she simply equates religion with philosophical sophistication. And for the Abrahamic faiths, that's Islam, Judaism, Christianity, religion is not based on our powers of reason. It's based on the claim that God has revealed God's self to us. In many and various ways, say Christians, but supremely in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. The third view is the more bizarre view, and this comes from people like Eric von Daniken and others. Is God an alien? And I've read many books in this area, claiming that, you know, turning water into wine was achieved through a Star Trek a kind of device, that the ascension was beam me up, Scotty. There's a lovely book called The Spaceships of Ezekiel by a NASA engineer called J.F. Blumrick, which talks about how Ezekiel 1 should be read as an alien visitation. I'm not convinced by this, either by the use of the biblical material in this way, but supremely in that it doesn't grapple with Jesus, who taught and lived a life of love in the kingdom, a Jesus who accepted death on a cross, Jesus who was raised again to life, but a kind of life that would die no more. I don't think this view really cuts it for me. The fourth view, I think I have a little more sympathy for, but not entirely. And that is, I understand why some will say, would this be the end for the Christian faith? And there's a lot of commentators who say that if we discovered little green women or little green men, if we discovered intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, would that be a closing down sale for the church? I understand why they say that, but I don't think that they're right in saying that. And the two main attacks come in this way. The first is that they say you Christians would not be able to understand the uniqueness or status of human beings anymore. But do you remember Nicholas of Cusa and the fact that Christians do not put ourselves at the center of everything, but actually what makes human beings special is the gift of relationship? So I don't think that this attack on the Christian faith has many legs to it. But I think where a second point is raised, which is really interesting, is about what would be the significance of the Jesus event to the whole universe? What would the moment at Calvary where Jesus dies for our sins, how could we understand that if there was other intelligent life elsewhere in the universe? And here Christians have disagreed in the 20th century. E.A. Milne, not A.A. Milne, but E.A. Milne, Oxford cosmologist, said, the Jesus event at Calvary is once for all for the whole universe. He said, I cannot imagine this happening elsewhere. The only trouble was he was then forced to the belief that Christians should become cosmic missionaries. And that's a very long missionary journey, by the way. That view was opposed by E.L. Maskell in his Bampton lectures in the 1950s. And Maskell said that the God that I see in Jesus would take on flesh on other worlds. And this has penetrated a great deal of Christian hymnody, spirituality. Some of you might know the name Sidney Carter, the Lord of the Dance. Do you remember that song? Well, Carter wrote another song, A Christmas Carol, in which he talks about high above the Milky Way, in another world, there's another stable and another manger where God takes on alien flesh in the incarnation. This is a really difficult thing to work out because Christian theology says that God became a human being for two reasons. The first is to show us what God is like, revelation, revealing what God is like. But there's a second reason for God becoming human flesh, and that is to die for our sins on the cross, salvation. So in the incarnation, human beings experience a God who both reveals and saves us from sin. If you know some of the science fiction of C.S. Lewis, you'll remember that what Lewis does is poses the question of if there is another civilization, might it be sinless? And therefore, do you need an incarnation in that? Now, I think there are lots of theological questions in this. I'm quite happy with John Polkinghorne, who once was asked about this question, who simply replied, I don't know, but the God that I see in Jesus would do what is necessary. I think that's not a bad answer at this stage. But if we go back to Oregon, remember that church father that we started with a very long time ago at the beginning of this lecture? Oregon had a view where the Jesus event could, its effects could be accessed and experienced throughout time and throughout space. And to give an illustration of this, let me tell you this scientific parable. Well, not a parable, an experience. Other day, not so long ago, well, a few years ago, I was walking down the street in Durham, and a fellow physicist in Durham came up to me with tears in his eyes, and he hugged me. This doesn't happen often in Durham, and it certainly doesn't happen between physicists. But it was the day of the announcement of gravitational waves, the discovery of gravitational waves. 100 years previously, Albert Einstein had said, if two big black holes bang into each other, then the effect on the space-time of the universe is that you get little ripples moving out into the universe. And he said, this will happen, but by the way, he said, you'll never see them because they'll be so small. And then the Advanced LIGO experiment was able to measure the stretching of space on the surface of the Earth. It was a very small stretching. It was a fraction of the diameter of a proton. But we saw that ripple of two black holes, that event that had happened at a different time and different space in the universe. Maybe there's a way of thinking about the Jesus event in that way. I'm nearly finished, Andrew, forgive me. Are you all right for another 5 minutes? Is that okay? Let me move on to what we might call the borderlands of SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, where theology and faith begin to not just rub up against each other, but actually inform each other. I think if we look at those who are fascinated by SETI, both in science and within what we might call the X-Files community, I think there are a number of themes here which are really interesting. And you get them in science fiction a lot. There's, first of all, this sense of cosmic loneliness. Are we alone in the universe? Wouldn't it be wonderful to have an extraterrestrial friend about the right size of E.T., the size of a child, which is Spielberg's brilliance in the movie? And then what about purpose? would an encounter with extraterrestrials help us to understand the purpose of the universe? And then what about our own identity? Science fiction author Ray Bradbury talked about how our search for extraterrestrial intelligence was partly a search for ourselves, because we learn about ourselves in relationship with the other. And there is this sense of cosmic fear, human vulnerability in this vast universe. You see this in the Flying Saucers of Independence Day or Alien, the fragility of human life. And a longing for salvation. In 1949, Fred Hoyle wrote a paper in which he argued that the interest in extraterrestrial intelligence, he said, was because we're looking for someone to save us from ourselves, the longing for salvation. Now, as a Christian theologian and as a Christian preacher, there are a number of these themes here which I find at the heart of the Christian gospel. God is the one who meets the need for relationship and friendship, and my relationship with God, I find purpose and identity. God is the one who is the strength in the midst of human vulnerability. And God, of course, is the one within the Christian tradition who provides salvation through the death of Jesus on the cross. So there's a resonance here. And then I think there's a challenge to religion of SETI. And you can't read the quote there, but it's from J.B. Phillips, a little book that some of you will know called Your God is Too Small. And one of the things I think about this area is a challenge to the way that sometimes we Christians, if you are a Christian, make God in our own image. Your God is too small, said J.B. Phillips. And some of these questions of astronomy and some of these questions of other life is a challenge to say, think bigger. And then the contribution of theology to SETI. What might I have said in a cathedral in Washington, D.C. about our future in space with Jeff Bezos et al.? Apart from, I'd love to go up in one of your rockets one day, Jeff, but anyway, apart from that, I think there's something here about us understanding in the Christian tradition what the nature of life and love and consciousness can actually be about. I think there's something about helping culture deal with the consequences of any future contact, if it happens. I think there's something here about how Christianity, remember the importance of observation, that this is an important scientific research program. You look at the universe because you don't quite know what God has done. And then there's something about the ethics. What does it mean as we explore space, as we explore other life, even if it's primitive life deep down in the permafrost under the surface of Mars? What's our responsibility to other life and other worlds? Now, I do happen to be a Methodist, and therefore I'm under contract to mention the name of John Wesley at every lecture that I ever give. Methodists have to do that. And occasionally, Wesley actually is relevant, not often, but occasionally. And Wesley, in this discussion about other worlds, gave the advice, be not so positive. Keep an open mind on it. That's what I want to say this evening. What I've tried to do is do a little bit about the background of Christian theology, a little bit about the science of exoplanets, and then talk a little bit about the borderlands and some of the theological questions. And now I am open to, I don't know, or I'm not terribly positive about it. Questions, comments, discussion.
Thank you very much, David. There is a roving mic. If you want to ask a question, hand up and Kate will bring you the mic. So there's one here to start with.
Thanks for the great talk. We've got one thing Fermi didn't think about, and I wondered what your opinion is on how long intelligent, and one thing looking at humanity, you might say, well, in the last 100 years, nuclear war, global warming, you know, as they gain the power of technology and more power with genetics and everything else, how long they will last. And I think that's one thing, like Brian Cox and others have said, well, there probably was intelligent life, it's just not here now. That, just your idea on you know.
Yeah, thank you.
I think that's a
really helpful question. And you're right, Fermi didn't take it into account, but it has been worked out by a number of philosophers, including people like John Leslie, in what's called the doomsday argument. And it's a difficult argument. You've described it extremely well, that might we one day wipe ourselves out? And there seems to be a really important point in history of intelligent development, conscious development, which is about at what point can you move away from the Earth so that life can spread onto different planets? So that lessens the risk to a global killer, whether it be a pandemic or a comet or asteroid or nuclear war. And so there seems to be quite a narrow bottleneck at the end of technological development before you then move into space. And that's part of the motivation for some people actually wanting to move into space as quickly as possible, that we don't come to the end of it. I don't think, for me, it's something that negates the Fermi paradox. Because I think it's important to take into account, but the argument isn't strong enough to say that a doomsday is inevitable for intelligent species. But you're right with to raise that objection to Fermi, and there are a number of important objections to Fermi which have to be looked at quite carefully. Thank you.
Whilst we're waiting for another hand to go up, David, you get the feeling as science progresses that we're becoming aware that there is almost a direction in scientific processes that means that should conditions like those on Earth exist on another exoplanet around another star in another galaxy, life of some form is likely to emerge?
I think that's again, it's a really interesting question, Andrew. And I think there is a debate within biology on this. So Stephen Jay Gould, famous paleontologist, said that you play forward the tape of evolution, and if you start in different places, you end up in different places. So if you had the correct conditions, it doesn't inevitably mean you lead to intelligent life. Simon Conway Morris, also paleontologist at Cambridge, argued that because of convergences within evolution, you can start with a random process, but you begin to form structures that are inevitable at the end of it. So, you know, the eye has evolved a whole number of different times through different routes in the evolutionary tree, but it's come about, I think it's 40 or something of that sort times. Now, if you take Simon's point about evolutionary convergences into the development of life on exoplanets, that is self-conscious intelligence an inevitability of that process? Or do you take the Gulgar argument? You've still got to have the environment right, and that's not an easy thing. Never mind, you know, what the intelligent life is doing to the environment itself, but just your sun might explode or a neutron star might pass, unfortunately, quite close to you. So there's a whole number of problems here. But I think you're right that there is often this sense of that life will develop. But what we've got to be careful about is that amoeba to an accountant thing. Because when Miller and Urey in the 1950s in the University of Chicago put together, you know, what they thought were gases at the beginning of the planet and passed through an electrical discharge and got amino acids in their test tube, so many people then said, it's inevitable and it's easy. I don't think that is the case. So there's a number of factors going on here. And that's why I think the importance of looking at atmospheres through James Webb, the importance of scanning the sky still for signals, the importance of Abby Loeb, who argues that we should really take visited Earth evidence seriously. All of these things, I think, are important for the scientific community to do, and I think something the theology would affirm.
And of course, billions of years have been involved, which is very difficult to mimic in the laboratory.
Very difficult to mimic in the laboratory.
One there, and then Tina.
Sorry, I hope this question isn't too simple. I have been listening, please. But could you just explain what you actually mean by life?
Yeah.
And if you actually were able to get into one of your friend's spaceships and go 100 million miles across wherever, and you landed to investigate whether there was life on that planet, how would you know whether there was life on the planet?
That question is not simple at all. Well, it is simple, but it's profound at the same time. So thank you. So there's a number of things here, and this is probably a long conversation over strong coffee for us, because it has a number of different levels. Let me just pick out perhaps one or two of the bullet points. The first is what we define by life is dependent on our experience of life on this planet. So we look at what we experience as life, and we define life in a number of factors, from ability to reproduce, a degree of agency, a whole number of things like that. But it's summed up in that old quote that was never in Star Trek but became associated with Star Trek, which is, life but not as we know it, Jim. Could there be silicon-based life? Could there be life, as Richard Feynman once said, in very, very small, microscopic form in the gas clouds of Jupiter? So there's always an anthropomorphic tinge to what we define by life. We have to start somewhere. And therefore, we judge life by our own experience of what we've seen life. That's the first kind of area that we can talk about a lot. The second is that transition from life to self-conscious life. And here, philosopher Stuart Sutherland, a number of years ago, in a dictionary of philosophy, said that nothing that has ever been written on consciousness is worth reading, because we really don't understand too much about it. Now, Daniel Dennett wrote a book a number of years ago called Consciousness Explained. So there is differences of view on this. But that sense of we don't fully understand what conscious life is about. However, the third area which you point us towards is how might we identify life? And one of the interesting experiments that's been done in the past is to ask the question, as we've slingshotted satellites and probes around the Earth, which is a way to send them out into the outer solar system, could we tell that the Earth had life on it by how we observe it from the outside, from orbit? So here we're talking about what the gaseous composition of the atmosphere is. We're talking about how green a planet is, because we think that chlorophyll is important. Are we looking for radio waves or artificial radio waves coming from a planet? Now, those are the type of issues that we've had a look at. And that's not an easy thing to do, but it is about the type of atmosphere that we think there. But, you know, I mean, you know, you can see a country which is covered in green grass, but that doesn't mean that rugby league is the state sport. So there's one or two jumps there as well. Fourth area comes from a Roman Catholic theologian called Stanley Yackey. And Stanley Yackey said that if the spaceship landed from elsewhere, Christians should be the first ones there to say hello to whatever life form came out, because they would believe they had common ground because of a common creator God with whatever form of life is there. Now, a lot of that is, I don't really know, in answer to your question. And I should have probably said that right at the start, and it would have saved us at least 5 minutes. But those are really interesting areas to talk about. So thank you for the question.
Tina.
We talked about who is out there or who might be out there. The second half was, what is the real future of humanity?
Yeah.
So how do you square the Book of Revelation with our life now? Do you think that Jesus is actually coming in real time? In which case, what happens at that point? Do you think there's a sense in which God might intervene to stop us actually blowing ourselves up and, you know, restore, maybe hold a conference and say, come on, guys, you do know how to clean up this planet, don't you? And we'll realize actually we did know all along how to do it, and we just were too greedy. So I certainly thinking about this, and I feel maybe that might happen, because we'll have to, it'll have to happen, as we are going to wipe ourselves out quite quickly. And then at that point, maybe the problem of communication will be resolved, because presumably God can just fold space and can transport us to the other galaxies where his, you know, other creations might be there, and then the interstellar travel could be a lot easier with God helping us. And also, what's the nature of heaven? Do you think heaven is a real new earth in this universe, or are we talking a different universe, or, yeah.
So I think I've got about 6 questions there, all of which, again, are very profound. So I'm going to have a go, but forgive me if I don't touch all of the questions. I think the first thing to say is that part of the Book of Revelation, which seems to me to be important in this area, is the end of the Book of Revelation, which talks about a new heaven and a new earth. And that's a very important kind of image for Christians. It's a future hope which is not just about a liberation from the body, or a liberation from this world to some kind of ghostly, grayish heaven sitting on a cloud playing a harp, but is about a transformation of this heaven and earth into a new heaven and earth. And to cut a long story short, for me, that's more than physical rather than less than physical. And again, that's going back to C.S. Lewis in a book called Shadowlands. Lewis said that many Christians actually believe that, this is a world of materiality and color and physicality, and when we die, our soul kind of floats up to a gray shadow lands. And Lewis said that's entirely the wrong way round. The biblical hope is that this is the shadow lands, and the future hope for Christians is a world that is more than physical. And the basis for my belief in that is not just because it's written in Revelation, but because of the historicity of the bodily resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth, which I don't think is a proof, but I think has strong evidence that Jesus was raised bodily. And for Paul in 1 Corinthians, it's not just the evidence of the resurrection, but the resurrection becomes the example of that which is to come, the first fruits, not just for our own future resurrection, but also for the transformation of the whole cosmos. Now, that's the kind of basis that I'm starting with. Now, how do we get from this creation to the new creation, heaven and earth, this transformative process? And it seems to me that God is a God of both process and event. We know that in terms of God's dealing with us as represented in the Bible. God is always at work, But God's activity is sometimes focused in particular events and eventedness, primarily in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. And therefore, I do believe in the importance of that biblical image of a second coming, because it seems to me that's expressing a particular event that will draw to completion God's work in transforming this creation into the newness of a transformed heaven and earth which is to come. Now, don't push me then about what that looks like or the times and the dates. We're expressly warned not to do that. But a God who works both in event and in process in that way. Now, then linking up the point you made with the point about doomsday, will God intervene before we get to destroy ourselves? And gosh, that's a huge question, because it goes to the heart of one of the big I don't knows, which is why God seems to intervene in miracle in the scientific process sometimes, but not always. You know, so a Christian who says, well, I went to Tesco and it was raining and I was praying because there wasn't a car parking space, and suddenly a car parking space opened up, and so I mean, praise the Lord. And part of me wants to go, praise the Lord. But part of me wants to say, Lord, really? With war in Ukraine? And to be honest, that Christian brother could have probably done with the walk to the shop and all the rest of it. Now, that's the problem of evil, of course. Why God works in some ways, but not always, and why some things are left as human responsibility and human consequences. And I don't have an answer to that. I don't have an easy answer to that. What strikes me again about Jesus of Nazareth is that this is a God who doesn't stand apart from the consequences of evil, but a God who bears the consequences of evil in himself. And I find that quite comforting without providing an intellectual solution to it. So I don't know whether there comes a point where God intervenes. In terms of the point about, I think I'm making my way through them, you'll keep me right. The point about God's relationship to space-time, and yes, he could fold space-time in different ways, making space travel very easy for us. But, I mean, that really raises the question of God's relationship to space-time. And that's, God's relationship to time has been an age-long Christian question. And just to pick up from where I started, where I think my view is that God's experience is richer than ours. There are some indications from models of the early universe that our three dimensions of space and one dimension of time crystallize out of many dimensions, 11, 21 perhaps dimensions. And I'm intrigued to just speculate about what God inhabiting those many more dimensions of space-time might be. Because we experience three dimensions of space and one dimension of time, which is very frustrating when you have to get a train back to Durham. But if you exist embedded in richer dimensions of space-time, then time and space are still real, but not as limiting as those three dimensions of space and one dimension of time. So might it be that eternity, God's experience of time, is not timelessness, but a much richer experience of the nature of time? I'm not sure I've missed. I'm sure I've missed some parts out, but those are some of the things.
I think we should move on. There's a question there. That's right, and the one at the end was next there. So.
Just picking up a little bit of that and possibly pushing you when you didn't want to be pushed. Please. On that. Have you reflected on Aquinas's sort of analysis of Jesus' resurrection, thinking about a universe governed by entropy?
Yeah.
And exactly what it was that happened to Jesus as he's resurrected, and the implications for eschatology, the Venn diagram with physical eschatology. Any reflections on that and that might push that a little bit further?
Yeah, please do push. Now, I have to say that I've not read Aquinas carefully on this. So, but I do think that the point that you're making is really important. That is that what can we learn about the from the resurrection narratives about physicality? And one of the things that's often been stressed by Christians, which I think is helpful, is that there is both continuity and discontinuity between the Jesus who died on the cross and the Jesus who was raised again. This was the same Jesus, the gospel writers seem to be saying. Put your hands in the nail holes, he says to Thomas. He eats fish. There's something physical about this risen Jesus, but there's something different as well. So that he appears in rooms with locked doors. He seems to appear to people at the same time in different places. He does this walk to Emmaus with a couple of disciples who don't recognize him. And I've heard many sermons about this over the years. You know, if you plot where the sun is in the sky and Jesus and the disciples were walking into the sun and they didn't have sunglasses or their eyes were full of tears after that. I don't believe any of it. I think Luke is saying this Jesus was the same Jesus but different. It was only when he took bread and he broke it that they discovered who he was. So I think what we've got in that physicality of Jesus is both continuity and discontinuity. Now, if we play that as the model of new creation, we're talking about continuity and discontinuity. Now, I talked a little bit about time and space there. Maybe the discontinuity is that we are no longer in new creation limited by just three dimensions of space and one dimension of time. Maybe we experience a richer experience of that. But I think when it comes to matter, stuff, that's a really interesting thing. Atoms, what's going to happen to them? And one of the things that we have discovered in the 20th century is that, particularly in quantum theory, is that relationship makes all the difference to how you perceive experience matter. The observer is important in this. You see this in relativity as well. So there's quite a complex web of not just individual atoms, but also how their complex patterns and how they relate to observers. Now, that means that you can push me even further on this because I've only thought speculatively and very briefly about it. And it's really interesting to think about. My office in Durham is just across from Durham Cathedral. Durham Cathedral is buried the Venerable Bede, this wonderful polymath of the 8th century. And Bede once asked the question. He said, when the risen Jesus ate fish, what happened to the fish? It's a pretty profound question, actually. What was the interaction between this creation and the risen Jesus? So it's something that Christians have been wondering about, and I'll go back and read Aquinas a little bit more. Thank you.
Question there.
I was just wanting to ask you if you had any opinions on, in relation partially to the Fermi paradox and other things, if there was a fundamental limit to technological progress ingrained within the universe to do with some kind of entropy or another phenomenon that we're not uncertain of. I'm reminded of, you know, like the phrase like nuclear fusion is 20 years away and it always will be, and jokes of that nature. Yeah. And I'm wondering if I could get your take on what would be the theological, philosophical, sociological, et cetera, implications if there was such a fundamental limit and we were sort of semi-locked into our own solar system or some other larger scale of schema.
Yeah, thank you. To be honest, I've never thought about that before. And that's a really interesting question. I'm a hopeful scientist in the sense that I think our experience of science and technology means that we can explore, understand, and use the world. And that often is in surprising ways. So it's not always what we think we'll be able to do. Sometimes it even surpasses what we're able to do. And nuclear fusion is an interesting case in point that you raise. And so I remain the kind of person who believes that one day there will be a theory of everything in terms of a coupling together of quantum theory and general relativity into quantum gravity. I think I do believe that one day we'll be able to solve nuclear fusion. That's a kind of optimistic hopefulness from my experience of science and technology. But there's a pessimistic side to me that knows that technology is never neutral when it's in the hands of human beings. And therefore, the decisions around what scientific experiments you do, how you use technology, is wrapped up in both the beauty of human beings and the sinfulness of human beings, the creativity of human beings and the selfishness of human beings. And so I don't think that technological progress leads to utopia, and I think the 20th century has shown us that. That's sometimes called the myth of human progress. I think we are moral agents to make decisions. And therefore, there may be areas of technology that we can do, but we may decide not to do them. And I think that's the real limit, if we have the courage to do that. Now, of course, that is not an easy question. You know, some forms of technology, if you look back at the Manhattan Project, the development of the atomic bomb, if you look at some of the controversy that's been around in recent years about human cloning, these decisions about science are not carried out by men and women in pristine lab coats who are doing moral philosophy in their spare time. They're embedded in military and strategic power structures. The exploration of space is now not just for NASA, but it's for a number of private companies who want to exploit space for profit. With human jealousy and pride going alongside a sense of serving others. Now, this is a really difficult area, but I think, you know, Christians in science and others have long held the view rightly that Christians are therefore called to be salt and light right in those difficult decisions of how we exploit, use, steward space. Christians who are given a vocation to be a scientist, that is not an easy vocation at times because of the issue that you've said. So in summary, I'm an optimist that we will be able to do more and more with technology. Sometimes it'll surprise us, but the question for me is how we make moral decisions about some of these issues. And in that, I have to say, for all of those complex institutions and structures, often I've found that scientists are open to talking with people of faith, because they realize just how complicated those decisions are.
David, I think we're going to have to call it a day for formal questions now. David will be around for 20 minutes or so before I take him down to the station. So if you've got burning questions you haven't been able to ask, I imagine you'll be happy just to...
Absolutely. I'll be happy to listen to them. I might not be able to give any answers.
But can I say a huge thank you? You stretched our minds, both in terms of the science and the theology and philosophy, and we're very grateful. So thank you very much indeed.